While we're still in the Enlightenment, one of its most distinguished scholars from UCLA, who's written extensively about this, and I read her deeply when I was trying to learn about this, is Margaret Jacob, Peg Jacob.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here. It was even worth spending the time on the 405 yesterday, which became at one point the longest parking lot in the country. So, and unfortunately, I have to go home tomorrow and teach the early Enlightenment to my graduate students, so I'm only able to be with you today. We think of the Enlightenment as a handful, maybe 24, 25 philosophes, that is somehow the essence of the movement. And while that vision is adequate as a way of remembering what this period is like, I want to complicate this and say that I think increasingly historians see the Enlightenment as first and foremost a populist movement, a movement that is born out of the strength and vitality of urban civil society, first in two countries, in England and the Netherlands, and out of that tinderbox that civil society provides, you can start the kind of fires that are started in the 1680s and that continue to burn right up into the 1790s. What do I mean by civil society here? I mean, first of all, in the case of the Dutch Republic, Dutch government was built on local civil society. The urban elites basically ran the country, and they met in clubs and societies and fraternities and coffee houses, etc. The Dutch were a population of about 1.2 million, and in 1700 were publishing 50% of all the books in Europe. And they were able to do this in part because Dutch censorship was virtually non-existent when it came to books not in Dutch. The good city fathers didn't really care very much what the publishing houses brought out in French or in English. And so you have this capitalist engine, if you like. I mean, these folks are there to make money, that is producing a vast quantity of literature in many languages, including Hebrew, Armenian, etc. All of those languages are produced in the Dutch Republic. And that in itself creates an atmosphere where it is possible to get just about anything published. And let me give you a sense of the kinds of just about anythings that are published in the very first generation of what we come to call the Enlightenment. And I see that as a movement that begins very abruptly in the 1680s, under the pressure exerted by French bellicosity. The perceived tyranny of the French monarch and church is the impetus behind much of the early publishing that makes up a body of text that we can describe as enlightened. This bellicosity took two forms. One was the persecution of French Protestants, including the Waldensians. Suddenly a campaign is launched against one of the most ancient heresies in the kingdom. And this culminates in 1685 with the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. This gave French Protestants three choices: convert to Catholicism, go to jail, or try to get out of the country. Now, in fact, it was illegal to get out of the country. And so many of the people who did leave had to leave children behind, parents behind, siblings, etc. So what you create, one always thinks to oneself, what were they thinking when they did this? Because here you've got 250,000 refugees going to essentially Protestant Europe, angry, bitter, hostile. I mean, what did you think they were going to produce? But a body of literature that was hostile to monarchy and church, that was enamored of English government in particular, until you get the appearance now of Anglophilia lauding of English form of government that emerges after England itself has its own revolution in 1688-89, again against a Catholic king who is seen to be capable of and wanting to impose both Catholicism and absolutism. So this is why the 80s is this sort of tinderbox on both sides of the English Channel. And let me just give you a sense of what could be produced in this first, what I've called the Radical Enlightenment, this first generation. We get the appearance for the first time, anonymous, pornographic literature, much of it set in monasteries and convents, always including the activities of clergy and aristocracies. Another favorite site is, of course, the royal court. And this literature, to this day, we don't know who writes this stuff, but it is available in many languages, particularly French, but also in Dutch, and it is published clandestinely. In the same period, you find people who were educated in the new science by close followers of Isaac Newton taking the contents of the Principia and using them, using in particular the notion that gravity works from the very center of bodies, to make the not implausible argument that motion must be inherent in matter. Indeed, Newton's own followers made the mistake of thinking, well, that must be the meaning of saying that gravity works from the center of bodies. What that gives you, that configuration, that intellectual configuration, is the foundations for materialism. And of all the virulent heresies to come out of the 18th century, materialism, which begins very precisely in the generation that I'm talking about, has a debt to Spinoza, to be sure, Pache, Jonathan Israel, but there are many, many sources of materialism. And that materialism runs a line from the early 18th century through to Diderot, right to Marx. It's the same intellectual configuration that permits the arguments to be created about the laws of human development being essentially the same as the laws of nature, and they are inbuilt, they are hardwired. Also in the same generation, again out of an international circle of free thinkers working in both England and the Dutch Republic, many of the French Huguenot refugees, surprise, we also get the most radical text of the 18th century. This is a document that was called the Treatise on the Three Impostors. In case you're wondering who those impostors might have been, it was Jesus, Moses, and Mohammed. That text circulated all over Europe. In fact, it was published in 1719 in a very, very risky and very secret effort by a Dutch publisher. And that 1719 edition was confiscated immediately by the Dutch authorities. Even though the text was in French, this was just too much for the authorities to bear. There are only two copies of that edition left in the world. One of them is at UCLA's Young Research Library. The other is somewhere, I think, in Germany. So those are the sorts of things that people are able to say within one generation. You move from being in a situation where it's almost impossible to imagine people not believing in God, to suddenly having available a range of possibilities about the definition you might give to God or no God, running from deism, atheism, pantheism, materialism, just plain outright atheism. What I want to point out then is that the first generation of Enlightenment and most of the subsequent generations fall on a political spectrum that we can, I think, reasonably describe as left, even though there was no left and right in this period. By this, I mean these very same people who are putting out the pornography, calling Jesus and Moses and Muhammad an imposter, and lauding the new science and the English revolutions, both the mid-century and the final one. These same people are hostile to monarchy, are convinced that some form of republic or some form of constitutional government is the future for Europe. And they are hostile to landed elites, and therefore they are frequently men of commerce. It's a mistake to imagine that the earliest proponents of this movement toward light, to use one of the phrases that was commonplace in the period, it's a mistake to imagine that these people are hostile toward commerce and trade. This is just not true at all. Many of them make their living in the open market with their pens, or are publishers or journalists and are involved by necessity in negotiating their way through market forces. If we look at the Enlightenment as a very long movement, increasingly I think historians see it as a deeply practical movement, as having an agenda in every place that you find people identifying with its goals, whether the goal be religious toleration or the removal of monarchy. Or, in the British case, the people we associate with enlightened ideas, values, etc., can now increasingly be associated with the earliest stirrings of industrial development. The economic historian Joel Mokyr, building upon the work of historians of science like myself and others, now argue that to understand the emergence of the first industrial revolution, you have to talk about an industrial enlightenment. And by this, again, he means that the range of published material available that describes technology in such a way that it can be taken up and replicated is absolutely fundamental to making it possible for cotton manufacturers in Manchester or linen and wool manufacturers in Leeds to experiment, and this is what they called their factory floor work, to experiment to define new ways of speeding up their machinery and reducing friction, et cetera. All those principles are available in a set of textbooks that have been in print now for at least 50 to 60 years and are widely actually used. So, for example, you can find in Leeds in the 1790s linen manufacturers who are talking about Newtonian laws of friction and trying to apply them to the ways in which bobbins could be made to work more efficiently. Mokyr and others now believe that this, if you like, cultural element, because if you're talking about science and technology and the publication and dissemination of literature, et cetera, you are talking about culture. This cultural element is also directly relevant to the earliest forms of industrial activity that can be located in the West, and those, of course, occur. The application of power technology is what I mean by industrial activity. Those occur first in Britain, although very quickly you find this in pockets all over Western Europe. So the Enlightenment in this vision is both a more, if you like, populist and widespread phenomenon. It has to be seen as larger than the 24 or 25 wonderful philosophers that there were. Not that the industries around those men does continue. I mean, there's a Rousseau industry and a Diderot industry, and there's people writing books about these people all the time. But there is also now a much more social vision of the Enlightenment that sees it as having political implications from the very beginning, and political implications that will mean that when you look at the revolutions that break out in Europe in the course of the 18th century, I think now the Dutch Revolution of 1747, the Dutch Revolution of 1787, and the French Revolution, of course, of 1789, not to mention our own, which is led by people like Jefferson who belong in the family of the philosoph. When you look at the personnel at most active at the center of those revolutions, they are, without exception, people who are self-identified with the Enlightenment. So it is a movement that is intent upon change, and change of a very fundamental and practical sort that, on one hand, could give you industrial development, on the other, could displace kings forever. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Peg. So pornographic priests, amorous aristocrats, rutting royalty, tout ça change, apparently. You mentioned that later we'll be going on to the Industrial Revolution and some talk about economics and so on, so there will be a link in there, but we'll put a practical case in between of this issue about whether we're all on the same boat or not, and have a discussion. As you will see after the break, we'll be talking with Dan Dennett, John Haidt, David Sloan Wilson about issues in evolutionary biology. But we'll be going back to this whole notion of cosmopolitanism, globalization, and the Industrial Revolution. Let me also mention that when you get outside, that there are some prints, some wonderful photographs hanging out there. We're very fond here of the Lunar Society, which was a group of industrialists, scientists, and folk who used to meet in England at roughly the period that Peg was talking about, including Erasmus Darwin and Matthew Bolton, Joseph Priestley. Benjamin Franklin visited on occasion, and I would hope he would be included in your list of Enlightenment folk. indeed. And so I asked, I think of the Science Network as a possibly some sort of a proto-digital lunar society. So at the last lunar eclipse, I asked Tom Barthol, who's a scientist in the computational neurobiology lab here, to take some photographs of the lunar eclipse. And those photographs are outside as one example of Tom's work. So do please pay some attention to that.